As for the New Testament, the process was quite similar to the Old. And to begin, we need to recall that for the early church, the word Scripture had the same meaning for the Jews. It meant the books of the Hebrew Bible. And there was never a thought for those earliest believers of a New Testament being written. And why would there need to be, right? They had the Scriptures. They had the firsthand words of Jesus and mediated through them to them through the apostles. It was all they needed, right? They had everything they needed. They had the Scriptures and they had the apostles right there. Why would they need anything else? But here is precisely where the challenge came in with that. And there was three challenges looking back into it, it seems. One was that as the church began to grow through the apostles' missionary work, many churches were without apostle witnesses to the teaching of Jesus. So how were these churches, many of them Gentile, to really understand the teachings of Jesus? What were they? How were they to know what he thought and what he would have taught them? Second thing was that early on, and perhaps because of the first challenge, we know that the church began to be flooded by all sorts of teachers who were teaching things other than what Jesus had taught. And what were these churches then to do without a credible apostolic witness to believe, to help them through, to know what to think? How were they supposed to handle that without anything there? And finally, what were the churches then to do when the apostles and the earliest witnesses to Jesus died? And from hindsight, when we look at it, we think, well, the response is, it's obvious, right? They needed a collection of writings. They needed something to be written down pertaining to life in the kingdom and the person of Jesus, something that would help them to direct their ways. But again, much like the Old Testament, the process toward this was very organic, and it took place over many years. And that's what we're going to see now. To begin, we know that throughout the early days of the church, letters were being written back and forth to various churches, and many of those letters we have today. And as the writers were eyewitnesses of Jesus, or at least at the very least in the inner circle of those that were eyewitnesses to Jesus, it should come as no surprise that the letters then were received as being authoritative for the church. And this is an important thing, that they were authoritative not so much because they were giving some new divine revelation, but because they were simply conveying and contextualizing what had been passed on to them by Christ. That's what made them authoritative, that they were communicating to these people and contextualizing that message, what had been passed on to them by Jesus. And we even hear Paul saying, "What I received from the Lord, I passed on to you as of first importance." He was just simply communicating to them, passing on to them what had been taught to them by Jesus. And that is where the authority of these scriptures came from. But here's the thing. Not only were they authoritative, but soon, even in the time of their writing, they began to see these letters as being on the same plane as the Hebrew scriptures themselves. Listen to how Peter refers to some of Paul's letters. He says this: "Bear in mind that our Lord's patience means salvation, just as our dear brother Paul also wrote you. He writes the same way in all of his letters, speaking in them of these matters. His letters contain some things that are hard to understand, which ignorant and unstable people distort, as they do the other scriptures to their own destruction." It's 2 Peter 3:15-16. You see what he's done there. Perhaps even inadvertently, he's linked Paul's writings with the other scriptures. It's quite the link that he makes. But at this point, there was no sense of them in the church forming a New Testament Bible for the churches. They were just, the people were just simply writing letters, and then later they were writing the accounts of Jesus' life, biographies of Jesus' life that would be important. But soon, though, we do know that the letters began to be circulated among the churches. And in fact, we also see them being collected and then circulated amongst the churches so that the churches could read what was being said to other churches. And in fact, we have evidence to their sharing in the scriptures themselves. In Colossians 4, Paul gives instructions that his letters were to be passed among all the churches of the Laodiceans. And in 1 Peter, We also see a similar instruction from Peter that his letters were to be passed through the churches that were known in what is today the region of Turkey. So there's a collecting and the sharing of these letters that the apostles themselves felt was important. But along with the sharing, soon after this, we also know that it became regular practice for the letters to be read alongside the scriptures in the church themselves. And in the middle of the second century, sometime around 150, which was about 50 years after the last letter was written, which was Revelation, we have the account of this guy, Justin Martyr, who matter-of-factly states that when the churches gather together for worship, the memoirs of the apostles were read together with the writings of the prophets. These things were happening now together in church. So within 50 years, we have this outside reference to the letters now being read in churches alongside the scriptures. And that's a pretty big step to see what's happening there. I guess the question is, which letters were being read? Well, about 50 years after Justin Martyr's comments, 50 years at the latest after that, the first lists begin to appear of books and letters that were being read in the church. And one example, one of the earliest examples of a list like this is something that we call the Muratorian Fragment, which is named after the person that discovered it. And the Muratorian Fragment references four Gospels. It references Acts, the 13 letters of Paul, Jude, two letters of John, and Revelation. And the letters that we do have in our Bible today that are not included in the Muratorian Fragment are Hebrews, James, 2 Peter, and 3 John. And in addition, there are some letters that are not included, which are not in our present Bible. Two of them, one's called the Wisdom of Solomon, another is called the Apocalypse of Peter. But with these, the fragment does say that some of the people do not want the letters read in the church. So there's this caveat there. And there's also listings of other books that the Muratorian Fragment says should be refused altogether. So what we get even from this then is this sense that there's already the shaping of the letters that we have today. But like with the Old Testament, we see the beginnings of the debates really as well that would carry themselves out for the next 200 years. And the next little significant marker that we come to is from a man named Origen. And Origen was one of the early fathers of the church who lived from about 184 to 254. You know, kind of after the apostles died off, he was in the next kind of layer of significant leadership in the life of the church. And Origen was an extremely prolific writing, and thankfully many of those writings we have today, we also have references from others to Origen's writings. And it's interesting then when we read his writings how his view on the acceptable letters for the New Testament shifts over time. Throughout his writings, he holds a view very much like the Muratorian Fragment, but over time this shifts so that by the end of his life, his views on the acceptable letters look much more like our present Bible today, like what we call the New Testament today. And for the next 100 years after Origen, the lists really kind of carry on much like his lists and his thinking, shifting, but generally built around this same core consensus. Except during this time, the convictions regarding accepted and rejected books become more clear among the majority until finally, by around the middle of the 300s, we are starting to see a real cohesiveness in the list. They're all beginning to look the same, and what they look like is what we have today. And again, as I said to begin, the process was really much like the Old Testament, you know, fluid and nebulous with this slow sifting over time of books that were to be read alongside the Hebrew Scriptures. First, there was this core set of books that was to be accepted. Many of those look just like what we have in our New Testament today, with some on the fringe. And then over time, it was determined what was best to do with those on the fringe. Should they be accepted in the case of Hebrews and 2 Peter and 3 John? Or should they be relegated to this kind of second level status, the Shepherd of Hermes, the Apocalypse of Peter? That is the books that could be read, but are to be understood again clearly as not things that we generate doctrine and final belief from. And that was really how the New Testament was formed. And this leaves us then finally with the question of our criteria. Why then were books received, or why were other books rejected? And by now it shouldn't surprise us, but the criteria for acceptance was quite loose. Nowhere do we ever find like clear-cut instructions being written down. These are the grid that we look and evaluate the writings through. But it does seem when we look back into the events and read what was being written back and forth from various leaders in the church at the time, that it does seem that there were some kind of ad hoc rules which govern the process. Really, it seems like we could say that there are about four things that seemed pretty important. First of these was apostolic origin or prophetic origin. And this was without a doubt the primary point of criteria. People were concerned that the books and the letters were attributed to, or at least based on, the preaching and teaching of the first generation of apostles. Or in the case of the Old Testament, and perhaps this is a little bit more nebulous, but that they were attributed to the prophets or to their circle. For the New Testament writing, this was particularly essential because people wanted to know that the letters and instructions that they were reading in church were from people that had the closest access to Jesus himself. And in every case, it seems, those books that were on the fringe, the reason why they were so was because people were uncertain about their origins, and they wanted to resolve that before moving ahead. Suffice to say that for now, that this was clearly a significant point of criteria when discussing and when they were working through the acceptability of letters. Another thing was the consistent message. And this became particularly important for the church when dealing with books that were on the fringe or whose authorship was being questioned. For these books, one of the key questions came with whether or not the books and the letters contained theological ideas that were compatible with other accepted Christian writings. And if they didn't, or it appeared that they were introducing new ideas, well, then they were pushed to the fringes until finally they were ruled out altogether. So that was the second thing. The third thing was plausibility. In addition to a consistent message, now people also apparently judged the books with just basic plausibility and logic in mind. I mean, can we easily rule out who the author purports to be, for example? It was quite common for people to assume the name of a significant religious figure in order to see their writing gain broader acceptance. So to write in the name of Paul, or to write in the name of Peter, or in the Old Testament, to write in the name of Jeremiah. That was a very common thing today to do. And so people want to know, like, can we easily rule out that the plausibility of this being a letter of Paul is pretty slim? The other thing is the part of that was, then does the book just contain details that frankly, when you read them, they just seem more fable-like? And the fourth point, which was very significant, was the universal acceptance and the universal use of the letters. It's evident that this was one of the clearest criterion. If a letter didn't have the acceptance of the majority of the people of God in all of the churches scattered east and west, then in the end, it seems that it just simply wasn't accepted. And the church in the east and the church in the west, they did arrive at different conclusions at different times. But there was still this consensus eventually that was meted out amongst the whole of the core books that would form the canon. And I suppose this is a good place to talk about what we call the Apocrypha, because in essence, really, this is really a listing of a number of the books that in the end were rejected, that failed to make the canon. And so perhaps doing this helps, in looking at this, helps shed a little bit further light on the criteria itself. The term Apocrypha refers primarily to a group of books that were written in between the last of the accepted Old Testament writings and the time of Jesus. So kind of a new or Old Testament era writings. But also, to a lesser degree, it does refer to a group of books that were written after the time of Jesus. For the Old Testament period of books, and you can look at the slide if you have it there, there's a number of books, some of them that might be familiar to you, that are included in the Apocrypha. One is 1 Esdras, 2 Esdras, Tobit, Judith, Ruth, or the rest of Esther, Ecclesiasticus, which we read about earlier on, Baruch and the Epistle of Jeremy, the Song of Three Children, Story of Susanna, Bel and the Dragon, which is one of my favorite titles of them all, the Prayer of Manasses, and then 1 and 2 Maccabees. And those were a number of the Old Testament Apocrypha books. The New Testament period books included a number of supposed Gospels, like the Gospel of Peter, or the Gospel of Judas, or the Gospel of Thomas. There was also the infancy story of Thomas, the Gospel of Bartholomew, the Acts of Paul, a number of Acts, Acts of Paul, Acts of John, Acts of Peter. These have all been surfaced. And to be certain, all of these books really had some measure of fame during the time of their writing. For example, we know that many of the scrolls that were found at the Dead Sea, which we call today the Dead Sea Scrolls, were scrolls from the Old Testament Apocrypha. There was a whole bunch that were from what we have included in our Old Testament today, but there was a whole bunch as well that were a part of the Apocrypha. So clearly, that devout Jewish community found value in this in these writings. We also know that that some of these books were found in the earliest versions of the Septuagint, like the Shepherd of Hermes, for example. And finally, we know that the New Testament era writings were also very much copied and distributed. We have a fair bit of manuscript evidence pointing to these. In fact, one of them was just been recently found, the Gospel of Judas, in the past number of years. But the thing is that's important is that we also know that these books were always viewed with, you know, a measure of suspicion, or at least they were viewed kind of on that secondary level. In the majority of our listings that we have, there is some sense that they just didn't find the same acceptance as perhaps some of the other writings did. In many of their cases, their authorship was unknown. And as I said earlier, in some cases, they knew full well that the writer was assuming a name in order to gain legitimacy. In the majority of cases, their message was in doubt, and in many cases, so was their plausibility. For example, in the infancy story of Thomas, we see the story of Jesus as a boy striking another boy dead and after being bumped by him. And incidentally, a number of the Gospels that were a part of the Apocrypha focus around the years of Jesus' childhood. And many people surmise that these were written because the four Gospels that we have don't really deal with much with Jesus' childhood. And so people say that there kind of arose this suspicion in people's minds, wondering, well, what was Jesus' early days like? And so as a result, then, a number of writings emerge to kind of, you know, satiate that need to know, well, what was happening in Jesus' early days. But as you see, like the infancy story of Thomas, many of them tell quite amazing stories or crazy stories about the early life of Jesus. In the Gospel of Peter, three men come out of the tomb with Jesus, and two of them have heads that reach to the heavens, and one has a head that reaches beyond the heavens. In the Acts of Paul, Paul is seen baptizing a lion, and it's a good thing that he does baptize him, because later on in life, Paul, in some type of game, would be thrown to the lions, but it just so happened that the lion he would be thrown to would be the one that he baptized earlier on, and as a result, then that lion spared him from death. So there was this plausibility question that was around these Apocrypha writings, and finally, they just simply never gained this universal acceptance. There was always a significant stream of doubt that carried through great portions of the church. And so in the end, then, it appears that the criteria that sifted some of these books to canon status in the end sifted others to the secondary place. And Hebrews and Protestants then chose to leave them out of their scriptures altogether. The Catholics, on the other hand, chose to include many of the Old Testament apocryphal books, not all of them, but many of them, while indicating them with a kind of, they refer to them as a secondary status, or they call them deuterocanonical or secondary canonical. And I don't know necessarily that I agree with the Catholics' decision that way. I'm not sure that they really would care. But the one thing it does remind us of is that their non-canonical status does mean that does not mean that there's no worth in these writings. It's just, again, that they didn't carry the authority with the early church for establishing what we believe. And I think most likely the wisdom of the early church is what should prevail in our hearts. There was wise people there, and we need to trust the process that the Lord led them through. You know, it seems to me when you put all these things together, the process and the criteria for the canon's formation, that we have something that I think is remarkably beautiful. But as I said all along, even in the introductory teaching where we just had some discussion a couple of days ago, which wasn't recorded, it was on the Sunday, and we just had questions and answered. What I said all along is that none of this is like a sealed case. None of the studies of the formation of the scriptures is like an open shut case. It just isn't. There's all sorts of open spaces and unanswered places and room for questions, and frankly, there always will be, and I'm okay with that. Because here's the thing about those spaces, is that they really are the place where faith is required of us, which it just seems to me will always be something which is required of us. God's always asking us to step out and to believe and have faith in the gaps. Nothing is ever perfectly sealed up. The second thing about those places is that, and I didn't talk about this on Sunday, is that the places are also, it seems, the room where God himself steps in and stepped into the process. I mean, at the end of the day, if we're going to give assent to these things as being sacred, and if we believe that there is a God, then we also then need to believe in his supernatural intervention and superintending in the forming of these texts. We have to give that plausibility. That was part of the story. At the end of the day, you know, we can go a long way to logically explaining how the scriptures came to be, but we have to, in this pursuit of God, leave room for him. We have to leave room for the supernatural. This is a supernatural thing that we're involved with, and we need to give room for his involvement. And I think that that's what these open spaces ask of us. Can we believe that maybe, just maybe, there was a God that was behind all of these things, that was helping to organize them and bring them together because he understood that his people throughout the generations would need something that they could sink into, that they could root themselves into, that would guide them in a way of righteousness and holiness. In the next, we're going to deal with two more questions, one dealing with authorship, and the other question dealing with the transmission of scriptures throughout time, and looking forward to that. Hopefully that recording can be a live recording. For now, thanks for listening in, and God bless you.